Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. In Plato's Symposium, the character Aristophanes expounds a myth about soulmates. Once upon a time, humans were a species of two-headed, eight-limbed creatures, but they attracted the wrath of the gods, and so to punish them, Zeus split each creature in half. Some split into one woman and one man, others split into either two women or two men. The nature of love, according to the myth, is a striving to reunite with the person who is literally one's other half. But modern notions of love are changing, and today's guest urges us to reconsider what love is and what it could be. Our guest today on Pathways is Carrie Jenkins, author of the new book, What Love Is and What It Could Be, a book about the evolving nature of romantic love. Carrie is a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, an elected Canada research chair, and the principal investigator on the collaborative research project, The Nature of Love, funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. Hello, Carrie, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we start exploring how romantic love is in the process of changing, let's try to define what we're talking about. What is love? I mean, this word can have so many meanings. What kind of love are we talking about?
Yeah, this is a really good place to start. So my work is all about romantic love specifically. So I'm one of the things I'm interested in is trying to distinguish romantic love from other kinds of love, such as the love between good friends or the love that family members might have for one another. So I'm interested in trying to get a sense of what makes some love romantic. And then within that, I have two approaches to trying to, I hesitate to call it a definition because I think that sounds too precise, but I'll say a theory, two approaches towards a theory. There's a biological side, and then there's a socially constructed side.
Okay. And what does make love romantic? Is it related to these biological and social factors?
Yeah, so I think that both are in play in different ways. So biologically speaking, I'm talking about things like the brain chemistry that's involved, the things that happen to us physically when we fall in love, when we experience love. And these are things that it's possible to study as a scientist, as a biologist or biological anthropologist, and people are doing that. I'm not a scientist. I'm merely kind of leaning on other people's research on that side of things. But biologically speaking, we are a naturally occurring phenomenon, and we can be understood that way. However, if you only look at the biology, if you just look at the oxytocin or the dopamine or whatever it is that's going off in your brain, you're going to miss the socially constructed elements of romantic love. And so this is the second half of my dualistic theory. And I say romantic love is part social construct, meaning that we have created as a society a certain kind of script that we expect romantic love to conform to. And this is, I think, largely about what makes romantic love romantic rather than what makes it love. But it's things like the idea that when you're in love, when you're in romantic love, it should be monogamous, it should be permanent, it should be, at least until recently, we assumed that it should be heterosexual, and that it should be sexual at all, and that it should involve maybe getting married, settling down, moving in together, having kids, and so on. That's the kind of script, and that, I think, is a social construct.
Right. And you point out in the book that not understanding what love is really puts us at risk because love matters. I mean, so many people make their most significant life choices on the basis of whether they're in love or think they're in love. And saying I love you is such a big deal. You make the case that this is a very legitimate thing to try to figure out rather than just passing it off as inherently mysterious.
Yeah, and actually I think passing it off as inherently mysterious is something that can be really dangerous, really risky. And sometimes I've put it like this, you know, if we were to think of the human body as mysterious and incomprehensible, then we wouldn't know how to fix it when it's broken. You know, we rely on a scientific and other understandings of ourselves in order to know how to survive in the world and how to thrive. And I think romantic love is the same, but yet we're sort of encouraged to do the opposite. Okay, we're told, you know, don't overthink it, don't overanalyze it when it comes to love. Just let it all happen and everything will be fine. And of course, it's often not fine at all. And so if we kind of acquiesce in this disempowering ideology that says don't try to understand what's happening, then, you know, I think that is a way of lacking the resources or failing to empower ourselves as much as we can to get the best version of love that we can.
Now, I wonder, why do you think we are so attached to what you refer to as the romantic mystique? I mean, we actually seem to celebrate how hard love is to understand. Why is that?
That's right. Yeah, so I don't know all of the answer to that question, but I have some speculations, some suspicions. So part of this relates to, so I call it the romantic mystique on purpose to hark back to an older idea of the feminine mystique, which is something that comes out of 1960s second wave feminism and Betty Friedan's work especially. And that this was the idea that women are incomprehensible and mysterious and but still very close to nature and special, partly because they were so incomprehensible and mysterious. So the feminine mystique was a similarly kind of disempowering ideology that encouraged us not to challenge or critique ideas of femininity, ideas of womanhood. So that benefited whoever was benefiting from the gender status quo at the time. Similarly, I think with romantic love, the romantic mystique that encourages us not to question or challenge the romantic script is benefiting whoever is benefited by the status quo, which is the status quo that tries to push everyone towards conforming to that script.
And who's benefiting from the romantic mystique?
It benefits, so I mean, part of the answer is the same, actually, the patriarchy. And I say that because in many ways, I think the social construction of romantic love and the social construction of gender proceed alongside one another. And you can see this in the fact that when you think about a romantic story, I'm using some air quotes here for romantic, but you can't see them, a romantic story, we typically picture different roles in those romantic stories for the male character and the female character, right? So if you watch rom-coms, there are romantic lead male characters chasing, pursuing, active in the process of courtship or whatever it is, whatever you like to call it. And there are female characters waiting to be rescued that are much more passive in that dynamic. And this, you know, you just have to think of something like the Cinderella story, which is the oldest example of it, is built into both our process of socially constructing gender, this idea that women are more passive, for example, and also socially constructing romance. So it tells us something about what a romantic story is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is part of the answer. Another part of the answer has to do with what is happening to our society at the larger scale as a result of the romantic script being the way it is. And so what's happening at the larger scale is that that script encourages the formation of basically of nuclear family units. And so it structures society into that kind of format. So it benefits anyone who is benefiting from a society structured in that kind of way, particularly those for whom that is a comfortable fit, right? So people who are monogamous people, who prefer to be in monogamous relationships, who want to have biological children with a romantic partner and so on, it benefits them and it harms everybody else who might want something different.
Right. This is a question that is related to the romantic mystique, the feminine mystique, and the differences between the genders. I mean, certainly there are some genuine gender differences, at least on the biological level, when it comes to hormones. Don't these make a lot of difference between the different genders and the way they behave and the way they approach each other?
My understanding is that the biology of gender is a lot more complicated than it's often made out to be. And so, you know, I'm as I said, I'm not a scientist, so, you know, you have to talk to an actual biologist to get a better read on this than I can give you. But my understanding is that there's been a strong tendency to sort of oversimplify the biology of gender in order to try to justify the social construct of gender. And so, you know, this is not to say, of course, that, you know, all humans are biologically identical. Of course they're not. But instead, what's really true is that all humans are biologically divergent in lots of interesting ways that don't particularly neatly conform to the binary structure that we've tried to overlay on top of it.
Right.
There's some really interesting work on this by an author called Cordelia Fine, who has a book, it's called Delusions of Gender, which is a title that I think is brilliant, where she deconstructs some of the attempts to prove, for example, that men and women are very different when it comes to their neurophysiology, so that their actual, you know, brains and brain chemistry and brain states. And she goes into the details of why it's been tempting to think that and to say that, and she breaks down the evidence and the attempts to prove it and finds that it doesn't hold up. So, you know, I think it's easy to sort of feel like, yes, there must be enough in the biology to explain at least the bulk of what we see manifested at the social level. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think there's always an underlying biological layer, and that's real, and there are things going on there. But unless we're really careful, it can be very tempting to overproject what's actually coming from the social construct onto the biology.
Oh yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, the social construct has got political elements to it. You know, the invention of private property. You reference the book Sex at Dawn, and you talk about Helen Fisher's theory about how women had to hold their children, so they needed a man to take care of them or protect them, which, you know, I agree with you, seems totally absurd. I mean, why couldn't she imagine that they had a communal situation where everybody's
taking, or even just a baby sling.
Yeah, or a baby sling, or both. Yeah. You know,
or both.
You know, because
if you look at the history, it suggests that the baby sling was invented earlier than the point when Helen Fisher says romantic love was evolving to solve this problem of female neediness. So, you know, the theories don't look that convincing once you start to really dive down into what they're saying, but they have a tendency to sort of sound natural, right?
Right. Well, we started settling down, and then we invented this thing called private property, which needed to be protected. And what else needed to be protected? Well, the women and children, it seemed. I mean, there's so many ways to explain the social constructs of how we got to this place. But the point I was making is, you know, I mean, males have, you know, the amount of testosterone that females have is minuscule compared to the amount of testosterone that males have. Now, I'm not trying to say that to justify social constructs, but I'm saying it's a radical difference biologically that affects behavior.
It depends on the individual, and I assume you mean non-trans people here. So again, you know, I'm not a biologist.
Well, yeah, people who haven't taken hormones, yeah.
Right. So I don't know what the specific numbers are. I believe it's true that they're, like, you know, statistically there's a correlation between having certain kinds of genitalia that we describe as male and having certain kinds of hormonal profiles that would include more testosterone. Yeah, I think that's true. Like, to the best of my knowledge, like I say, not a biologist.
Oh, Yeah, I know it's absolutely true. Yeah. But I'm talking in generalities. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of exceptions for sure. And we have to accommodate those. You know, this whole issue of what love is and what it could be has a very personal relevance for you, doesn't it? Because of your mm-hmm. particular situation. I mean, in the book, it starts out, and it's really kind of an interesting wake-up call when you say, on the mornings when I walk from my boyfriend's apartment to the home I share with my husband. And right there, I mean, that's kind of like an aha moment when you're reading this book. And it sort of puts things in perspective, why this is such an important, interesting issue for you.
Yeah, it came out of, I mean, the book comes out of my personal life and my professional philosophical interests just sort of colliding, really, and leading me to go down this path of trying to use philosophy to understand why, you know, I'm a non-monogamous person, and why people would tell me that being non-monogamous means that my love isn't real. It's not like, if you were really in love with someone, then you just wouldn't have any feelings like that for someone else. You would have no eyes for anyone else. So this was something that I would hear, and then, you know, that made me start wondering, then, what is this thing called love that they're talking about, such that you can't do it with more than one person, and why can't you do it with more than one person? And these, you know, given my background, they just really sounded like philosophical questions to me. So I started thinking, can I use the tools that my training as a philosopher has given me, tools for thinking, for analysis, to try to dig deeper into the reasoning behind those responses and reactions.
Mm-hmm. And I love the way that you point out that this is a conversation we need to have about the nature of romantic love, because the social mechanisms that reward normal love, and I'm using the scare quotes here, mm-hmm. and penalize everything else.
Right.
So what are these? Let's talk about these social mechanisms that keep everybody in line.
So, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you could think about here. I mean, one obvious example is that we give legal and formal privileges to certain relationships when they're recognized by the state. So when people get married, mm-hmm. we privilege that relationship over various other kinds of possible relationships that people can have. And we privilege it, you know, with financially, with tax benefits, and socially in lots of ways. We celebrate that. You know, it's a big party when that happens. Everybody's very happy about it. So we can look at this sort of formal stuff, but at the much more sort of less tangible, informal level, there's also things like the fact that, you know, when my boyfriend explained to his parents that he was together with me and that I was married to someone else, they stopped talking to him. His father still won't talk to him about anything except the weather until he breaks up with me. And that kind of rejection, you know, utter rejection by family is one of the other mechanisms that's used to try to stop people from doing something that goes against the norm.
Right.
It didn't work on him. Unfortunately for me, he decided to stay with me, but it was an attempt to stop him from doing something that was going to break a norm. And then there were things like the horrible trolling that I get online for being an openly polyamorous woman, which includes all kinds of, vitriolic comments that you, again give you an insight into the fact that gender is relevant here, because people use the kinds of words that you would not use to describe a man to describe me for having two partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it seems to be very important to people that that a woman shouldn't be doing this. A woman shouldn't have two partners.
Right. Right.
So all of this is an attempt to sort of keep me in line, you know, try to make clear you've crossed a line here and you need to go back. You need to go back into the box.
You know, I'm just curious about your boyfriend. Is he polyamorous also?
Yes.
Okay. So he's got another girlfriend.
So both my partners see other people.
I see. Oh, it's it's fascinating. We should do a whole show on that sometime because it's so interesting. How do romantic love stories reinforce these harmful stereotypes?
Basically, the problem is not any one individual story, but the fact that we keep telling the same story over and over again. You know, we keep seeing a story where two people, and it's usually a man and a woman, get together. Maybe it's a bit awkward for a while and there's some drama, but then they get together and it's going to be happy ever after. We keep seeing that story, and we don't see very often at all, for example, a polyamorous love story. The closest things that I've seen, you know, I went to see, do you know the Spike Jones movie, Her?
With the computer
operating system.
Right.
And the computer operating system seems to fall in love with this human man. But then she tries to explain to him that she's also in love with 641 other people.
Right.
It doesn't go very well. But there is some interesting, you know, that is at least an interesting idea to explore that idea in a movie. But, you know, we just don't see a happy three-person relationship as the end of a romantic story really at all, ever. And it's because of that, what we're doing is we're sort of helping to shape the social script for romantic love into, you know, this one single configuration that requires monogamy, it requires permanence, and it usually, I mean, it also usually involves sex, right? So we're not seeing, for example, asexual romantic love stories represented.
Right.
All kinds of ways that love can be exemplified that don't get to be part of the norm, because we just keep telling the one story over and over again.
Right, right. It sort of reminds me, I happened to watch a while back this crazy show on television called The Bachelor. And at the end, the last episode, he's in love with two women. He's not supposed to tell anybody he loves them, but he actually tells two women he loves them. And then he's torn because he has to choose one. And I was thinking, wow, why does he have to choose one? I mean, why?
Right.
You know, so it's exactly what you're talking about. But mm-hmm. I think you, as you point out in your book, there's some reason for hope, because now we are starting to find acceptance for same-sex romantic relationships.
Right. And I think this is a really good moment in time for this kind of philosophical reflection to happen, because what that shows us is that this construct changes, it can change, that we can take it, you know, and into our own hands to say, no, we would like to see more acceptance and more inclusion. And by doing that, and by representing the stories of queer people as romantic stories, we're able to expand the scope of the social construct to include them. And so, you know, seeing that happen just over the course of my lifetime is in some ways inspirational, because it's part of what makes me believe that this social construct, although it's you know, it's quite rigid at the moment, it's also malleable in the sense that we can change it if we want to. Collectively, I mean, not any one individual, obviously,
right,
but collectively we could change it. And I think the same was really going on in the generation before mine with the move towards the inclusion of interracial love, which had very similarly stigmatized and, you know, excluded from being represented as normal. Even now, you sometimes see amazing kinds of pushback against the representation of interracial love. You know, like, wasn't there an Old Navy advert a year ago, or even was it even this year, where there was, I think it was a black man with a white woman, or the other way around, and some kids in the picture, and there was just this, you know, really vile trolling on Twitter in response to this representation of what to me looks like a normal, healthy, loving family.
Well, there's so much.
So, you know, any kind of progress is so vulnerable to being lost, I think.
Well, we've only got a couple more minutes, and there's so many things we can talk about. I mean, in this book, you're talking about all of the problems that we have with this one-size-fits-all romantic love template. But, you know, you also point out that it's changing, and we just talked about a couple of ways that how it already has changed. What do you see? What do you see as the future of romantic love in our culture?
Well, there are lots of possible futures, and, you know, I make a few predictions, mostly just to have the fun of sitting around and being proven wrong. But, you know, one of the predictions I make is that we might move towards thinking of love as not necessarily intended to be permanent, so perhaps even eventually seeing temporary marriage contracts. And this partly, I think, might be a move that's made to alleviate the enormous pressure that's building up behind the idea that you have to have one true love forever, and the fact that just seems to be explosive and very difficult for a lot of people. So it's a way of relieving the pressure on that.
Right, right. And obviously, most of the attempts at marriage are failing these days. So we obviously something's not working very well.
Now, yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, pretty much as we're drawing to an end here, you point out in the book, if you had to whittle the book down to one message, it would be a simple one. Think about love for yourself.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that in closing?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Really, this is about what I was saying about the fact that we have a lot of control, but only collectively, no one individual. And so I can't just write a book where I say, look, this is how it is. This is what love is. This is what we need to do. Bam, we're done. That wouldn't work. What needs to happen is for more people to challenge the romantic mystique, to push back if they're told not to overthink it, that they shouldn't be critical of love or they shouldn't analyze it, and say, no, hang on, I want to understand. I want to know what's going on here. And so I don't really care whether people agree with anything in my book, so much as I care that they think about the questions that I'm asking and engage in a dialogue about the about these issues, because that, I think, is the way for us to take that control back, that responsibility that we have for making love evolve into the best version of itself that it can be.
Yeah, I like the way that you put it in the book, that we need to develop, quote, some minimal awareness of what a huge thing we are doing. Romantic love cannot continue to be something we just stumble into and accept the way it is, unquote. That's beautiful. And I want to thank you, Carrie Jenkins. I would love to talk a lot longer, but we've pretty much run out of time. And before we go, I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners about your website.
Oh, yes. My website is just carriejenkins.net. And you can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Carrie Jenkins on Twitter.
Okay, beautiful. Thanks again for being on Pathways.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this entire interview anytime you like via the internet or podcast on iTunes and other servers. Today, we have been visiting with Carrie Jenkins, author of the book, What Love Is and What It Could Be. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are also available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, and on iTunes and other podcast outlets. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Carrie Jenkins and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.